Welcome to the Future of Teamwork podcast, where we explore cutting-edge strategies to keep teams human-centered, drive innovation, and empower you with the tools and insights needed to help your team excel and thrive in today's rapidly changing world. Your host is Dane Gruneveld, a seasoned expert with over 20 years of experience enhancing team dynamics and innovation. Today, Dane is joined by Alex Draper. In 2015, Alex founded DX Learning, a company committed to eradicating workplace toxicity. His book, Care to Win, The Four Leadership Habits to Build High-Performing Teams, embodies his approach. At the forefront of the People First movement, under Alex's leadership, DX Learning has transformed over 40,000 leaders globally. Tune in to discover, first, why human skills are not soft skills. Alex explains how clarity, autonomy, relationships, and equity, care, are crucial for achieving results and getting the hard work done, proving they are anything but soft. Second, how bias and threat scanning affect teams. Our brains constantly scan for threats, leading to biases that can hinder trust and collaboration. Alex shares how recognizing and managing these patterns can improve teamwork. Finally, the six-step process to behavioral change. From adopting a growth mindset to reinforcing new habits, Alex outlines a practical framework that helps leaders and teams create lasting improvements. So, teamwork makes the dream work, and we're here to inspire your next collaborative breakthrough. Gather your team or put on your headphones and let's dive in together.
Welcome to the Future of Teamwork podcast. My name is Dane Gruneveld, CEO of the Huddle 3 Group. And today I'm joined by Alex Draper. Alex is the CEO and founder of DX Learning. He's the author of Care, Four Leadership Habits for High-Performing Teams. So it's a great topic to be diving into today. And he's coming to us from a log cabin in Wisconsin, which also sounds cool. So Alex, this is going to be a fun conversation.
Hey, Dane. Thanks for having me.
You bet. So maybe you can bring our listeners up to speed on some of what you've been sharing with me about your journey with DX Learning and now the book that you've just recently published.
Yeah, the book really, the name of the book speaks to the work that we do, which is Care to Win. Let's be honest, we in the world that we live in, we do have to win. And I think it's how you win is the most important part. We have to win. We have to drive performance. We have to get a result. As an entrepreneur and business owner, if we don't get I don't make enough profit, I can't keep the people who come to work for me. Can't send them home to their families and their kids with food on the table. So we do have to win. I think the most important part is how. So the how is care. It's how do we drive the people first, human-centric movement in a world where AI will never care, humans do. So my passion and my life work is about, how do we care for each other so that we win? And care is not the cuddly type of care, as you might think about it. It's the human skills to get the hard stuff done. C stands for clarity, A stands for autonomy, R stands for relationships, and E stands for equity. In our research, in basic psychology and social science, these are the things that when we have these and in the right levels of these, it stops the threat circuitry in our brain being triggered. And when the threat circuitry is triggered, it releases the unhappy drugs, the survival drugs. And how can we perform at our best and win when we're full of anxiety and stress and our brain is not performing at its best? So that's, in a quick synopsis, that's our work and that's my passion.
That's super neat. And talking around threat circuitry and unhappy drugs, how did you come by that body of work, and you know, where did you start running into it first?
So that's a good question. DX was, we founded it in 2015. So we're 9 years old, and around 2018, so part of our former business was basic leadership training. And for any business owners out there, just a degree of empathy, we were in-person only leadership training up to March 2020. And the world came tumbling down when I got a series of clients calling us saying we're canceling it. And as you can imagine, it was one after the other. Yeah. But our former business was in-person only leadership training. And we had one of our simulations where you basically drop leaders into it, and it's a pressure cooker. You unearth people's natural tendencies, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And after watching thousands and thousands of people go through this program, you start to see some common themes as to why people were failing in assimilation. And it was in, I then hired a head of psychology expert, and we just started to analyze, well, what is causing teams to fail from a leadership point of view. And we just started to see common themes of it's that setting expectations, people getting really upset as a team member when they don't have the clarity that they needed. And then you started to see, well, once you start to fix that, what happens next? And it was when people get controlled and feel that they don't have the agency, they get upset. And why are they getting upset? Oh, we started just to see patterns and to see people's where triggers for stress and disengagement came from. And you saw it was clarity, you saw it was autonomy, you saw without a sense of human connection and trust, people, you could see their brain triggers, which ultimately led to whether someone felt this team was fair or not, which got us to equity. So while we didn't call it clarity, autonomy, relationships, and equity, we saw it was around ambiguity, lack of control, lack of connection, and perceived unfairness. And then we just sat in a room, probably with a few glasses of wine, and we're like, ooh, that sounds like clarity. And we're like, oh my God, that spells care. And that's
nailed it.
And that's where it was like, isn't that cool? Care. And that's where it was born, just out of pure evolvement and a little bit of luck. We got to where we got to.
I love that. And it's a really cool, just that soundbite that you said earlier, it's not the fluffy kind of care. It's the, you said the human skills to get the hard stuff done. That's really meaningful. I've seen a lot of people talking about soft skills being tangible skills, but I think this is actually going to the next level.
And I say this a lot and I speak to it a lot. There is nothing soft about human interaction and leading human beings. We've got to stop calling them soft skills. We reframed it to human skills, because in the technology revolution that we're in, and for me, that's what we've got to double down on, is humanity and human skills. And there's nothing soft about leading human beings.
No. I really like also the way you explained that it came from a place of ambiguity. I was on with another guest, actually just this morning, and they were telling me about a platform called Talentism. Have you come across Talentism?
No.
Okay, so it sounds cool. I've not used it, but they said Talentism helps people move from confusion in a business, so ambiguity, to clarity. And it is a data-driven approach of finding those points in the organization or team where confusion exists, so that you can have interventions to remove the confusion and create the clarity. Yeah. So it's a very different way to think about designing work, but it seems to be very much in line with where you're getting started.
Agreed. And just continuing that line of thought, so where we're going as a business is to understand what gets in the way of team dynamics and trust. And if you think about it, there's what people get from the team and the team leader, and there's what people need. The bigger the gap between what I get and what I need, the more threat circuitry is triggered, and the more I'm in a space of I can't be my best and I can't do my best. So think about that when it comes to clarity. What's fascinating is we all crave clarity, because in the old days with the tribe, if I didn't know where it was safe to eat, it meant death. If I didn't know who was on saber-tooth duty that night, it meant death. Yeah. So we crave it. But in terms of what you actually need, so I'm an entrepreneur. We're all very slight. Our preferences for these and what triggers the threat circuitry is going to be a different preference and on a different scale. But that's the beauty about this. If you're a CFO and you're talking to me and you're going to present to me a 10-page document, it's going to trigger the threat circuitry. Too much clarity. Now, yes. I'm a low preference entrepreneur, but I can revel in ambiguity. I weirdly quite enjoy it, but I'm a unicorn. So when I'm communicating with my COO, if I give her what I'm comfortable with, which is one sentence, because I can roll the sentence. You give me one sentence, I'll figure stuff out. But that one sentence to her would trigger her threat secretary, because she's like, well, I wanted a 5-page document. Same with autonomy, man. It's like some people when it comes to control. Some people need a lot of control. Some people don't need much. Same with relationships. So it's that spectrum between what I get and what I need, where we all can work on every single day. And just think about everyone that you communicate with my kids, with my wife, with the soccer team that I coach. Are they getting what they need, and how do I close the gap?
I really like that framework. I hadn't heard of it in that way, but having played with some of the different instruments, you know, the discs, the MBTIs, it makes total sense. And it also kind of resonates with that whole five love languages too, like knowing what someone wants rather than giving them what you want, which is where things often fall down in relationships.
It's the old, what's that old golden rule of treat people how you want to be treated, which is reframed now to as simply live with the mindset, treat people how they want to be treated.
Yeah. Yeah. But, which goes to show you can't build a common framework to say, this is how we have meetings or this is how we have tough conversations, because everyone's different.
And that's really, isn't that the beauty about what we're trying to get at here? Create a simple playbook that we all can use, regardless of generation, regardless of diversity, regardless of circumstances, give you a simple playbook. And within that playbook, understand that there's different preferences. But I think this, I'm a fan of the saying, simplicity scales, complexity fails. We've made communicating and engaging with human beings really, really complex. My industry has done a terrible job of just simplifying human interaction.
Yeah, that's interesting. So, and when you say your industry, Alex, is that the learning and development industry or HR, or how do you bound that?
Yeah, it's the leadership development, talent development industry. Low barrier to entry, zero barrier to entry. There's about 1,000 models. There's 3 million books on leadership. I mean, we're the people that we serve, our managers. I mean, they're exhausted. And every year they read the next book and go, well, is this the next thing I'm supposed to be doing? But you didn't really master the previous thing. So it's like, well, I feel we just need something that's evergreen, that's going to stand the test of time, like the love language, just to galvanize human beings.
Yeah, I think that's great. I didn't realize there were that many business books. I knew there were a lot, but 3 million. And you hear the stories, don't you, of, oh, we got a new CEO and they came in and this is their favorite book, so we're all now having to read it and work with it, which is so draining.
Yeah, until the next book comes along.
Yeah, absolutely. You also talk about fairness. So, you know, equity's been a big word in the world this year with SHRM's positioning on it. And yet you're coming at equity from what seems like a more universal kind of value of fairness standpoint. Tell me a little bit more about how that's been playing out for you and what you see transpiring in teams right now.
Yeah, it's a good question with the current environment. So our definition of a dimension of equity is to adapt to the unique needs of the individuals that you serve. So it's which in its purest sense is very human, very simple. We're not going down what I would call as the DEI route, although we are, because when you adapt to the unique needs of the people that you're working with, you really are being inclusive and leveraging their diversity. But we're putting the simple leadership and communication doctrine of just adapt to the unique needs. Now, how would you know what makes them unique if you haven't built relationship with them? Well, you tend not to build relationships with them and get to know what motivates them, what their values are, because we haven't given them autonomy. And why do we not give people autonomy and give us the time of day? Because we don't have clarity. So that's sort of how the care equation works. But the biggest struggle that I have, so I'm part of Vistage. I'm both a member of Vistage, so it's a great peer group for CEOs. I also speak. So I did 16 sessions this year. Yeah, I can just see it when I talk about, when I open up the equity section of care, I see the emotional challenge to what it is to the CEOs that I'm talking to, because I know where they're coming from. Our experiences with the word equity have probably polarized us more than we need to. So I understand, empathy. I think we've gotten maybe a bit lost. And what we're trying to do is put a very simple human frame of, it's what you can control is how you adapt to the unique needs of the people you're communicating to. And that's, we're trying to make it that simple because that's something that we can control. We can't control the system. It's almost like Covey's sphere of influence, control what you can control. You can control adapting to the unique needs.
That's neat. So it's a real call to action for the leader in the team or the team member on the team to serve those unique needs of their team members.
Yeah. And if they're not, if your unique needs aren't served, right, there's a one-size-fits-all approach or you make a sweeping assumption that, you know, you're this person because you look like that, so I'm going to assume that you're that, then that leads to that trigger of unfairness. And in the brain, when unfairness is triggered, it's disgust is what's felt. So we're just trying to lower the disgust by people feeling, I hate to say it, seen, valued, and heard.
Yeah. And that's, I really like this framing, Alex, and it makes me think back to what you shared on clarity too, that some people are going to be really high on fairness and some people are low. It makes me think of my 13-year-old son now. He has this a massive expectation for fairness in everything, not just in his life with his siblings and parents, but when he looks at things out in the outside world, he's like, that's unfair. I hate it. It's just a very polarizing response to what he deems as unfair. So I would imagine you see that in teams too.
Yeah. I mean, whether it's a team is a family unit. I've got a 7-year-old and 6-year-old. You've got your 3 children.
Yeah.
That's a family unit. That's a unit. That's a team. I coach soccer. We both played rugby. That's a team. Mm-hmm. My DX team, that's a teams. I mean, teams are just made up of human beings. I think, again, goes to the we all need to win. For my soccer team, it's winning. Hopefully not.
Yeah.
Not badly winning, but like, you know, if you lose, you lose. For my kids, it's making sure that they are learning, growing, and developing. For my team, it's making sure that they have food on the table and they can go home to their families, being present at the dinner table. We're all trying to win at something, and I believe we're more, no, I don't believe, I know that we're more likely to win when our needs are catered for, and it's, there's no one size fits all approach to that.
That's brilliant. And let's dive in a little bit more on winning, because I think I even butchered the book title when I introduced you, so Care to Win. The winning piece, and you just touched on it, some people might think of it as a bit toxic or a bit capitalist in mindset. So if I'm, I think you did a good example with kids, but if I'm in a not-for-profit organization that's here to help, you know, develop future leaders in nursing or whatever it is out of a community, how do I define winning in that team if I'm applying your equation?
Well, you start the conversation with the right trigger, which is winning. Winning is polarizing, but we just got to face the facts. In America anyway, this is capitalism. It ain't going to go away anytime soon. So the winning is winning, which is why I called it. It took a long time to get to the book name, and we kind of knew that it would be polarizing, but I'm okay about that. I think it's if you don't face the facts that we're all trying to win at something, then I think that's a problem in its own right. But to answer your question, a nonprofit, well, their winning is mission driven, the mission to serve a greater good. So you're more likely to win and serve that mission if your team dynamics are high trust, because there's low gaps between what people are getting and what they need. Whatever the team, there's always a mission. There's always something that we're doing to perform, whether it's profit, whether it's revenue, whether it's employee engagement, whether it's increases in knowledge. I know it's how you frame win, but it's important that you do understand that we all are trying to win at something.
Yeah, I like that. And it can actually, for some reason, I just went to playing golf and the handicap system in golf, because the cool thing about the handicap system is if Alex is a scratch golfer and I don't play very much and I've got a 36 handicap and Alex has got a scratch, then, you know, winning for me is just doing better than my expectation level. It's not beating Alex on actual strokes on the course.
Yeah. Because that's winning for you. And I think we all need to define what winning is to us and write that down. And my job is to say that, well, you're more like whatever you're, and I haven't found a place yet where whatever you wrote down in our training programs, the first thing that we ask them is write down what you're trying to win at. I'm not going to ask you, but at the end, I'm going to ask you this. Do you think you're more likely to win at whatever you wrote down with either more or less clarity, more or less autonomy, or more? No, every time it's one of those or two of those, or in some cases it's three, and you can relate nearly everything that we're trying to win at to some sort of lever of clarity, autonomy, relationships.
That's neat. So let's play out a scenario then. So you go into a business, you're running the training, and they've all got their own win formulas. And then you get deeper into the training course and maybe that equity one comes up, that fairness comes up, whether it's something to do with compensation or access to information or whatever it might be. Do you find that moving from that training dynamic that you actually start getting into sort of planning, system intervention, system redesign, does that kind of take you down a very different pathway with some of those cohorts?
Depending on, I think, to your point, does the thing that we're trying to win at involve changing a system, right? Or does it? I think there's probably two ways to frame this. It's either, does it involve changing you and how you step up and what you can control?
Yeah.
Or is it a case of we have to change the system? As a business, we don't get into the system piece. If that's the insight that you have left with, that's still a win, but I can't help you with that.
Got it.
Probably a tougher win to change the system than it is to change you. My business and my whole theory, everything that we do is about changing humans and to dial back the selfishness that we're all born with to survive, right? We're all just trying to survive. Our brain is literally created, a couple of thousand heuristics and 188 biases in order to scan for what we're processing between 11 and 60 million bits of information every second.
It's a lot.
It's too much. And we're not ready for the technology revolution. I always say we're human beings are running advanced societal software technology on cave person hardware, the brain. and we ain't ready for this, man. We're just survival. So it's easier to change yourself than it is to change a system. And I think if I can change, I always say if I change one, I can change 100. So we're more on the human system change. Same thing, right? Still a system versus macro level, changing a whole culture, implementing systems. That's not what we do, but if we can create that insight, that's still a win.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you get a leader, to your point, if you change one leader who can change 100, they may use systems to drive their learning from your program. Yeah.
Yes.
That's very cool. So cave person hardware, that's one of my favorite sound bites I've heard in a long time. Tell me a bit more about that.
Well, not much has changed in 300,000 years. We've just swapped saber-toothed tigers for bosses.
Yeah.
but if you think about it, you know, cave person hardware, the brain, it's still a threat scanning machine. There's threats, but its job is to keep me alive at all costs.
Yeah.
It's the primary purpose of the brain is to keep me alive. So it's scanning for threats. It's processing the bits of information. In order to do that, it has to make assumptions. So heuristics are brain shortcuts to make judgments and decisions as quickly as possible to reallocate resources to go back to scanning for threat. So the negative effect of a heuristic is a bias.
Yeah.
So if you think about team dynamics, which we're talking about here, if you don't manage your biases and your assumptions that you're making, like I bet you all of you on this call right now are looking at me going, well, he's British, so he's got bad teeth. he must like cricket and the food's terrible. That's an assumption your brain's making about me. But if you don't challenge that assumption, how can we collaborate as a human being? So that survival mechanism is basically we're just assumption making machines.
Yeah.
And if we're not challenging those assumptions, the team dynamics, that goes back to that get versus need. The bigger the gap between what someone gets and what they need is driven by our inability to manage those assumptions that we're making on a daily basis.
That's really neat. I hadn't really thought about it in that way, and particularly, as you say, how threat scanning, you know, turns those heuristics into biases, which actually kills curiosity. And curiosity is such a key theme in a lot of conversations we have on this show. So, you know, if you're going through your framework in a coaching engagement or in training, how do you bring in exercises or sort of methods to drive that curiosity up to kind of overcome those assumptions?
I just want to give you some recognition and credit for the fact that you've triggered the most important word about it's really curiosity, man. Isn't that what drives the human race forward, is our ability to always be seeking? Was it Bill Nye said, everyone knows something that I don't?
Yeah.
Are we curious enough to find out what that is? And that's how you move the humanity forward. Anyway, so yes, it's all about curiosity. To know that the first part of change is to know that you need to change. I think the one common bias that we all have is, it's not me, it's you. Everyone else is biased, it's not me, which of course is a fallacy. So what we do is to help people understand that they are human. They have a brain, and that brain is an assumption-making machine. I love the way your brain works, because you get what we do. We create experiences for people to see their bias in action. For example, illusion of agreement bias. The bias that when two groups of people interact with each other, leave that conversation or meeting assuming that they're on the same page when in fact they weren't. For example, for you, Dane, if I was to say this word, just tell me what you think this word means to you. Ruler.
Yes. I'm thinking a 30-centimeter piece of wood that I draw straight lines with.
And I'm thinking King Charles II. That's an example of illusion of agreement. When I say one thing and we say we agree, I say, hey, can you design me a ruler this week? And you go, sure. And then a week later, you show me your metric ruler. I'm like, what the? And so, but that's the illusion of agreement bias. Another one that really is a challenge for all of us, the law of least effort. For example, Victoria, my daughter, she knows how to tie her shoelaces, but she's always late for softball. So when she comes down the stairs and she goes, Daddy, Daddy, in her American British accent, she goes, Daddy, Daddy, can you tie my shoelaces for me? What does a typical parent do? Tie the shoelaces, because the consequence of being late for softball outweigh me just control. There's your control. So the law of least effort, it's quicker and easier for me to tie someone's shoelaces. So a question for all of you listeners, how often do you tie the shoelaces of your team or children when in fact, because if you're tying the shoelaces for them, they're not tying themselves and learning and growing. So there's that. What we do is we create experiences that allow people to go, holy moly, I never saw it. I am biased. Because you can't change and close the gap unless you realize that you are an assumption-making machine. So we help people see the fact that they're assumption-making machines and go, I never knew that. That consciousness that creates the curiosity.
That's awesome. That law of least effort is very interesting. Again, guest I was on with today was talking about this concept of dive bombing her team. And she was like, sometimes when the going gets tough, I'll just jump in and start working on something with them. Right. But that's tying the shoelaces when I put the two together. And she was saying the problem with that is I think I'm helping and they're all sitting here going, oh my gosh, the boss just jumped in and started doing my work. Does that mean they don't trust me, believe me? They've taken my autonomy away. This isn't how I do it. And it just creates churn and discomfort.
Oh, we call that the anchoring bias. When I speak first, just because my brain's telling me, go first. It's easier for you to go first and go last. But when you go first, you essentially anchor the team. So the anchoring bias. And when you anchor a team, they're less likely to speak up and challenge the status quo. So all of these is just the unconscious way the brain works. It's the unintentional consequences of being human. But unless you're managing those unintentional consequences, then unfortunately the team doesn't get what they need.
No, they don't. And I would imagine that that's going to create, we've had a number of guests come on the show and just talk about how we're overworked and we work around a lot of people and problems and systems in business. So I imagine that's draining a huge amount of energy from human energy from our teams.
But I would then go, are we overworked, burned out and stressed? Because what's the actual root cause of that? I can guarantee you 90% of the time it's clarity. I told him in relationships, because if we spend a lot of our time duplicating work, doing rework, double checking people's work, because we don't slow as smooth as fast. We're not on the same line on the same page to start with. And the gap only gets bigger if we're not aligned at the start. And I personally think we're burning ourselves out. That's,
I think you're right. I was actually on with my coach earlier today. And he was asking me some of the things that I'm setting out as goals for next year. And I said, I don't want to work as many hours in the week. And he was like, you're terrible at that. He goes, you work because you feel comfort in working. You feel like if I'm working hard, then I'm managing, you know, all of the potential threats and, you know, optimizing for what's in front of me. And so that to me is my coach calling me out for not being clear.
And as a entrepreneur, I can't speak for everyone. I think that's called the illicit transference bias, where we assume when one person acts this way, it means the same for the whole group, right? All rugby players are thugs. No, we're not. But it's as entrepreneurs are the speed that the bias for action probably usurps our ability to take a step back and really think things through and get clear up front. It's just the nature of being an entrepreneur and leading small, fast-growing teams.
Yeah, that's very true. So when you're doing these exercises, Alex, in a group environment, are they role plays? Are you doing simulations and videoing people so they can go back and watch themselves? Like, how do you create that real aha moment?
No playback, no role play. Here's what I've learned in doing experiential learning for 20 odd years is when someone can blame the system, when someone can blame an algorithm, when the failure is not me, it's something else, then I'm less likely to change. So everything that we build, the only thing that creates the failure or the mistake, no failure, well, and sometimes but mistake, or you get to see that bias is because it's you and you alone. And that's what I've learned. And that's my challenge in my industry and the industry in general is a lot of scrap learning, a lot of tick box stuff, but doesn't get to the core of someone's not going to change unless they have first come up, bought into the fact, autonomy, that they need to change in the first place. And again, survival, any excuse for me to not change, because no one likes to change, right? No one likes to change. Any excuse I can give that this is not me, it's not me, it's someone else, right? So it's self-awareness. They ain't going to do it. So everything that we do, all the activities per se is always built around creating an activity where the single source of failure is the actual person themselves. And they go,
interesting.
God, I do do that. Damn it, I do that. You tricked me. No, I didn't trick you. It's you. So
I like that.
Yeah.
So is that sort of a lot of introspective reflection work that you'll give someone a piece of work to do, they'll look at it and they'll sort of write it down and then sort of talk it through with the group or with you as an individual, as a coach?
Yeah. So our learning paths are you can't change the world in a 1 hour, 2 hour, 1 day experience. So think of just basic learning. Our job in the spectrum of learning is step one of change is, in fact, we've got a six-step. Here's our six-step learning process behavior. Let's have some fun. So step one is growth mindset, that's that curiosity, right? The knowledge and mindset that you're not there yet and you will never be there. So that's step one. How do you get people into that mindset? Because if you come to any event, any learning event, anything in the world and you think you're perfect, then, well, that's a problem. So I truly believe humility and vulnerability are the non-negotiables of the work that we do.
Yeah.
So growth mindset, step one. Step two is self-awareness. Tasha Urich, who's got a empirical research, in her wonderful book, Insights, tells us that 95% of us think that we're self-aware, but only 10 to 15% of us really are. That's a problem. So step two is what you see in the mirror, how much congruence is that with what other people see you? And again, the bigger the gap, bigger the problem. So step one, growth mindset. Step two, self-awareness. Step three is acceptance. What we found is when you show someone that the mirror that they thought that they have is not the mirror that actually people see, that creates the threat circuitry and people get, oh my God. So just don't worry about it. You're just human. So it's the science of the fact that your brain is designed this way.
Yeah.
So is that step three? Step one, growth mindset. Step two, self-awareness. Step three, acceptance. Step four is best practices. For me, step one, two, and three is the permission to learn. What we tend to do in my industry is we go straight to best practice. Hey, here's the next best tool for providing clarity, or hey, here's leadership, right? But then they're like, well, I don't need this. What are you talking about? Because without step one, two, and three, you can't give them a best practice. So that now you can teach them. So step four is best practice.
Yeah.
Step five is relevancy and applicability. So whatever you're teaching, whatever the best practice is, if there's dissonance between what it is and how they can use it, that's a problem. So you've got to make it applicable. You've got to meet them where they are at. So whatever, I think this six-step process can apply to anything in life. We've just applied it
including to my marriage. I'm taking very close notes.
Well, maybe that's the next podcast.
Yeah, that's right.
And the last piece is reinforcement. Big fan of James Clear, big fan of Charles Duhigg and the power of habit. It's about repetition.
Yeah.
So step five is step six is reinforcement. My business, what we do encapsulates all six, but the secret sauce is step two, self-awareness.
Right.
But it's a journey. It's a journey to betterment. And I think our industry has got a problem is you probably either pick step four, best practice, or let's just get some scientists in and talk about acceptance. We need something that encapsulates all six.
Yeah, that's brilliant. And you're right, self-awareness and acceptance, they're tough. They don't come naturally, particularly when we live in this world where you're thinking, well, I don't want to put my hand up and say I've got a problem here. Goes back to your vulnerability as a non-negotiable.
Yeah, but isn't that the problem of capitalism and a perfect the corporate America? And I can only speak to corporate America because it's just what I've done for the last 9 years. But it's the hero mentality that you got to be right. It's all on the leader's head, and I think that's a problem we got to solve for.
It's interesting. This year, I've moved through some very interesting transitions in a couple of my teams, and one or two words that I've used a lot more than, or in fact, I don't think I'd ever used them before, but I've used them a lot this year is embarrassed and ashamed. And I've said that in a few meetings. Hey, I'm really embarrassed that we're here. I'm ashamed that I made that decision and, you know, or hadn't raised this topic sooner. And it's so relieving to have that conversation with team members. And then what follows is just magic because they're like, we're grateful that you're sharing that. We're seeing this, and it just creates a whole lot more openness to really talking about what is happening rather than just telling good stories, which so many teams get stuck on.
I think there's a whole chapter. It's the last chapter of the book, all on vulnerability. Without it, there's nothing I can teach you, there's nothing I can do for you unless you lead with vulnerability. And I love what you just said. It's such a powerful word. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm embarrassed. Imagine not only what I love about what you just said is it felt good. The weight on your shoulders just dissipated, but also the weight on their shoulders dissipated because oh my gosh, this is great. When was he? I'm glad he said that because I was waiting for him to say that. But if he didn't say that, I'm like, if he can't say that, I can't say that. If you're not embarrassed, that means I can never be embarrassed. if you never make mistakes, that means I can never make a mistake. Like the culture of a team is a mirror of its leader, and kudos to you.
Thank you. And actually, it's more my coach than me. Interestingly, that concept of shame too, the way my coach was walking me through it is, if you're ashamed of something and you're not sharing it with people, it compounds because it's still there. And then you go and you make another decision to try and make up for your shame that you didn't do this thing earlier in the year, or you made the wrong choice. And all of a sudden you're acting out of a bad place. You know, fear-based decisions, shame-based decisions aren't generally good for you or your team or your customer. So it's interesting how we tend to kind of bottle these things up and let them fester.
And I love the way you chose that word, fear, because remember, it's the fear that triggers the threat circuitry that releases dopamine, cortisol, and adrenaline, that the survival drugs, right? That fear.
Yeah.
Ambiguity drives fear. Not being in control drives fear. Not having a sense of belonging and a sense of connection drives fear. Unfairness drives fear. It's fear.
Yeah. And it's painful. It doesn't help anyone.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's about creating great teams, is about reducing fear within teams. That's at its basic simplicity.
I like that a lot. It's funny. I've been talking a lot about reducing misery in teams, but actually I think misery is often attached to fear.
Yeah. Agreed. Saber-tooth tiger. Cool. Are you a saber-tooth tiger, or are you the safe blueberry to eat? Because if you weren't the safe blueberry to eat and someone else ate it, well, more for them. Won't eat that blueberry.
Yeah. That's right. It's crazy to think where we've come from.
Yeah.
It would be remiss of me to finish this conversation, which has been flying by, without talking about rugby. I know before the show we were talking about humility in rugby. So what was your experience of that environment for creating some of this passion, interest, and belief in these behaviors?
I mean, as this whole podcast is about teams and team dynamics, you look at all the people I played rugby with from a very early age, even at 8 years old, are still friends today. Yeah. That's something. How many teams that you go to war with, because that's what rugby is, but it's still transparent to my being a parent is like going to war every day. Running my DX is like going to war every day and playing rugby or soccer. But there's something about rugby and going on that rugby pitch that you do get beat down. You do lose a lot. But it's that growth mindset of you get back up. You got your team behind your back. It's not about one person. There's no, in fact, in the teams that I've played, that arrogant, egocentric person kind of gets voted off the island pretty quickly. There's no room for ego in it, in that environment. And there's just something about the camaraderie of and the humility of, you go to war for 80 minutes, but afterwards you hug and drink with the opposite team. This guy just literally punched you and broke your nose. I remember breaking someone's leg once. It was in the final of Midwest final. It was a try-saving tackle. I broke his leg, and he went to the hospital, came to the bar afterwards and said, "Man, that was a great tackle. Congratulations."
Isn't that amazing?
Whatever sport does that, but that drives humility, man. And then it's the same with ice hockey. We had this conversation, and how do you recreate that humility in teams? Because it's infectious. It's that's what we need to recreate, that juice that we have in rugby. Would you agree with that?
I totally agree with it. And that kind of after match interaction is very interesting. I think the military do that in certain circles. It's kind of like a debrief. And I fear that in our teams, we don't create enough time for that debrief to say, hey, that went, everyone talks about like postmortems. But we do postmortem if things go badly, and it's more of an investigation. What will we do differently next time? But we don't really sit there and reflect on how we came through a test or a challenge, how we won on the day, what we would do differently, just in a more holistic team kind of open environment.
Which goes back to your word of the day, which is curiosity. Doing after action reviews is driving curiosity. It's if you think about going back to the science, it's Dr. Daniel Kahneman and Thinking Fast and Slow, one of my favorite books of all time. System one brain, biases, heuristics, survive. System two brain, slow, deliberate, ask itself questions. You need to engage the curious side of the brain, but we don't like to be in the curious side of the brain. The brain prefers to be in system one. So we have to be deliberate and intentional with creating the curiosity, because it won't happen in osmosis.
Yeah, you're right. And actually, that's a great point. One of my coaches used to call them wisdom questions. You know, when you're down there in your animal brain, ask a what question, because that part of the brain can't answer a what question. It brings you back up here and you're in, you're curious, you're moving in the right direction, hopefully.
It's a wonderful, simple thing. And I say, there's only three good questions. They start with what, how, when.
Yeah.
Any other question can lead to fear, because you ask a why question, you end up looking down into drama, and that drives fear. Again, this all goes back down to fear. Is the question that you're asking creating insight and excitement and positivity, or is it making someone look into the fearful part?
Yeah, no, that's neat. I'm sure we're going to work with Alicia to weave fear somewhere into the title of this show. It's been a great conversation. Always enjoy connecting, having just met you this week. It's been two great conversations, but this one's been nice to share with the listeners. I love the way you talked about the human skills for the hard stuff, Alex. The context specificity, and particularly like what someone needs and what they get, and not creating models that are one size fits all, you know, creating a framework that allows people to really be intentional about who they're working with. I think that's great for teams. The cave person hardware, awesome soundbite, and the way we wrapped up there at the end too, just the fear-based, the threat scanning, driving certain behaviors that are going to encourage biases and cause harm in simple terms. Thought that was super cool. And then as we got into that that middle piece there on kind of the six elements of learning, and particularly those first three, growth mindset, self-awareness, and acceptance, you know, preparing to learn, I thought they were really cool. So super helpful for any team that's out there trying to drive a bit more change through their organization.
Oh, cool. Thank you.
So if anyone wants to find you, find the book, Care to Win, you know, engage you guys at DX Learning, how do they best connect?
Probably the easiest way is LinkedIn. So check me out, Alex Draper, DX Learning. I post every day and all of this stuff. So come follow me there. The book has a website. Either just Google Care to Win or alex-draper.com, and our company website, dx-learning.com.
That's awesome. Well, enjoy the log cabin in Wisconsin. Enjoy the whiskey. And I look forward to continuing the conversation and friendship. Alex, it's been great.
Thanks for having me, and appreciate the insights. I always learn a lot from listening to other people, and I've also learned a lot today. So thank you.
Thanks for sharing. Thanks, Alex.
Thank you for joining us. Remember that by embracing vulnerability, trusting our intuition, and approaching challenges with compassion, we not only strengthen our teams, but also pave the way for a future where collaboration thrives. If you're hungry for more insights, strategies, and research on collaboration, head over to thefutureofteamwork.com. There, you can join our mailing list to stay updated with the latest episodes and get access to exclusive content tailored to make your team thrive. Together, we can build the future of teamwork. Until next time,